seem they're legal. They seem to have everything in order. They aren't afraid when they see an official go by. They aren't hiding. They don't stay way high in the trees and that sort of thing, as some of the people do. Now,
I didn't want to stray on this because we are on a different schedule altogether.
I've got a Representative Starr has a particular interest in this area. Yes. And, you know, what I'm going to ask you to do is if you talk to him after the meeting.
I just wanted to use that dead time and no more.
No, okay. Okay, we're back on the record.
I don't want to take too much time here because the point's been covered very well. I wanted to say that we have old cherry trees, not old, no, 17 years old, but they cannot be picked mechanically. This orchard wasn't put out with the idea of picking it mechanically. The trunks are too short, and by now the trunks are very solid and hard to shake. So if we're driven out of picking by hand, our only recourse is to plant a new orchard and prune it accordingly and go that route. So we're in an area where we're stuck to pick by hand as long as we keep this particular orchard. Something was said over here. The gentleman said he joked about staying in business from one legislative session to the next or something like this. Maybe I'm bitter, but this is the way we feel about it. We talk in the family. This is a family operation. I have a son that's in a partnership with me, another son coming in the partnership with me. I originally started in a partnership with my father, so we're here a long time. But we talk here among ourselves, well, how much longer are we going to be able to pick by hand? We feel that it's a temporary thing with as many laws as we have coming against us. I think that the area's been covered, and I should sit down.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming out. Next one, is it Mr. Bosey? I would hope that the public, you know, I know when I used to come up to the legislature in much the same capacity most of you had, that when the representatives would be walking in and out, I began to wonder if anybody even really cared. The problem is that, as most of you know, that we're into the third month of the session, and most of us have bills that are pending before committees that are meeting at the same time. And there's generally a rule that most of us live by that if you have your name on a particular bill and you don't show up, that's an indication that you really don't care what the committee does to it. And the reason you see everybody coming in and out is that there are a number of bills that are before committees today of which members are sponsors. And they have to go to the different committees to tell the people just briefly that they're still interested in the bill and they want them to pass it. So I hope that you don't think that there's any lack of interest on the members on this particular measure. It's just that they've got too many things to do at one time. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Alfred Bose, B-O-S-E. I live out east of Albany, and we farm different crops, but we have some raspberries, and if this bill would go through that, we'd have to pay $2.20 an hour for picking, we'd be out of the berry business. Because most kids, they come out there and they like to visit and play with each other, and they enjoy themselves doing this. And we don't condemn them or try to force them to pick, but they just pick a while and then they'll play a while. And this keeps them off the streets in town, and all these ideas and bills they have to try to get people out of the cities and get them out someplace in parks or different places. This is a good way to keep them out of the streets for a time at least. And then about picking, if we had to pay this amount, some pickers only pick around 50 pounds a day. If you had to pay them $2.20 an hour, it would come to $17.60. For the berries, if you pick them, we only get 34 cents on the market for these berries, and we're paying 35 cents a pound to get them picked. So you can see we'd get out of the business real quick. And some pickers, they pick much more than this, and they could make a lot more than $2.20 an hour, and they'd quit right now if we only pay them $2.20 an hour. And the rest of the witnesses on this bill before me, they covered everything, that I agree with them. That's all I have.
Does anyone have any questions, Mr. Bose? Thank you, sir, for coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Mr. and Mrs. Kennedy?
Kennedy.
I'm sorry. With a name like Kulongoski, I should never make a mistake of doing that.
Cliff and Lois Kennedy. K-E-N-A-Z-Y, from Benton County, from between Corvallis and Albany, our strawberry fields are. Cliff and I do lots of things together, but the part of farming that I get involved in mostly is the supervision of our strawberry harvest. We've been raising strawberries from 1962 on and have had a range of acreage from 17 to 30 acres in harvest at any one given year. We annually hire crews of from 225 to 350 pickers. Now, our situation is quite different from that in East Multnomah County or Washington County. When we first started growing strawberries in Corvallis in 1962, the strawberry pickers were really not used to picking strawberries. The ones from Albany had been picking strawberries in Linn County for years and years, but there hadn't been very many strawberry fields around Benton County. And it's interesting now, our average crate per day is now almost competitive with other areas of the southern Willamette Valley. We still don't average as high as Washington and East Multnomah County. Somehow, Washington County strawberry growers have yields that are unbelievably high when compared with Benton and Linn County yields. But basically, what has happened is the strawberry picking has become a family tradition, and now in our fields we have kids who are the younger brothers and sisters of the kids who started picking for us, you know, 5-10 years ago, and it has become a family tradition, and we do have good success. We bring all our crews to the field by bus. Our field now is about 5 miles out of Corvallis, about 5 miles out of Albany, halfway between. These kids are supervised by the most valuable employees in the whole agricultural business, as far as I'm concerned, and they are the most important employment or hiring decisions that we've made. We find women who are gentle with children and yet firm, who love kids but who believe in the value of work. They hire the kids, they drive the buses, bring them to the fields, supervise them in the fields, and take them home again. We do not have primarily farmers' kids coming to our field. In Corvallis, we have kids who are the children of doctors, professors, laborers, teachers, research scientists, foresters. You know, I was thinking in preparation of this testimony that we used to think of public schools as being the great equalizer. But when I went to school in Western Pennsylvania, you could really tell who the poor kids were and who the rich kids were by how they dressed. In the strawberry field, you really can't tell the difference between the doctor's kids and the laborer's kids because they're all in dirty jeans and they're all really working hard, some hard and some not so hard, but working together. Is this a positive experience for these kids? Yes, it is, and when it is no longer a positive experience for the kids, then we will no longer be in the strawberry growing business. I think philosophically, if we did not believe that it was a profitable in terms of the total experience for the employees, we could not morally continue with the operation. Sometimes it has been profitable for us. We've been able to have our own children have work experience, and we've been able to make a fairly reasonable living. It has not been a means of acquiring great wealth. But we do believe that it's been a good work experience for the kids and for our other employees, and therefore we really would encourage you not to pass House Bill 2654, because we would agree with the other testimony that's already been given that it would be a means of putting the hand-picked strawberry operations and the other hand-picked crops out of the other farmers who grow hand-picked crops out of business. Strawberry pickers average between 10 to 18 days per year, and this is over a 3 to 4 week period of time. A lot of the kids who work for us in the age range of 12 to 15 do not do other hand-picking work over the summer. This is their couple weeks of work. It's also their couple of weeks out of town, being bussed out of Corvallis mostly, into the country where they are with close to the river, close to trees. It's just a whole different experience. It reminds me of the kind of fresh air a child experience that we used to have when I grew up in the East, and I did not participate in that, but many families I knew did have fresh air children from New York City or from Pittsburgh or wherever. It's in Oregon, we don't need a fresh air program because, at least in certain Corvallis, we don't, because the kids do have a chance to get out in the country, and it is a good experience for them. The part of the value of that initial work experience is a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old has an opportunity to be responsible to someone other than his parent for a work experience, and we try to make it a very positive experience for his first work experience. The 12-year-old oftentimes is only a 3 or 4 crate picker a day. But by the time that child is 14 or 15, he is making a good wage and enjoying his time. I mean, and not only enjoying his time, but making it worthwhile financially. And so we would strongly urge that you would not pass HB 2654 out of committee. Now, I am aware that you have are giving consideration to a lower minimum wage in some of the other bills that are coming up on your agenda, so that there would be a what would it be, $1.30 or something under one of the bills, and $1.85 under another of the bills. The matter of record keeping, which you have brought up and inquired about, would really make that a very difficult thing. I've tried to think how in the world we would operate that, and if we would, you know, if we would say, okay, we will pay a minimum wage that would be $1.85, but then if you go over so many crates, you know, if you pick more than that, we would, you know, give you the piece rate. The record keeping would be just phenomenal. We do try to keep good records. For instance, in keeping with the law that you're not supposed to employ anybody more who has worked in agriculture more than 13 weeks, we require all our row bosses to have on file an application blank from each child who works for us. And that application blank has a parent signature on for the kids who are under 14. It certifies that they have not been in agriculture more than 13 weeks in the previous year. We do keep, the kids keep their bonus, their stubs from each day's picking, and at the end of the season, they return those bonus stubs to us with an application blank, and the row bosses then certify that that child is available or is eligible for a bonus. And so we do have a fair degree of records, but it would be nothing like if we had to pay them on an hourly wage. Our payroll runs, we would probably come under that $20,000 factor if, above, okay, we would come in under that stipulation. If it would be in a year when the berry harvest was early and it all came in June, you know, if it was a late year and half of it came in July, then we might squeeze by, but it would be a very difficult situation for us. Cliff?
I might respond to some of the questions that have been asked. As I recall, our picking bill last year was either $22,000 or $27,000. In Oregon, I think it's roughly 6,000 acres in berries, strawberries now. And if there's 10 pickers to the acre, that's 60,000 kids out picking. Most of those would be kids, at least in our area, they're all kids. So that would, if we had to go on an hourly basis, I'm satisfied that we would fold up and go out of the berry business. So that would be 60,000 kids out of work there, out of a work experience. Now, we aren't raising berries just for the kids, because we found that we'd had a few good years in the berries, and it's been an okay crop for us. We also raise sweet corn and green beans and wheat and alfalfa. And actually, to be honest with you, we probably wouldn't be in, I wouldn't have stayed in the berries this long now if my wife didn't enjoy it so much. And I find that I've got some kids growing up that enjoy it too. But anyway, this wouldn't ruin me. With some difficulty, I could get the other crops in a couple of years, I'd be in gear and going again. But here would be 50 or 60 kids in Oregon that would be would not have this opportunity to work anymore. One other problem involved, I'm considering putting out another 8 acres of berries this spring, and I already have my plants ordered. Now, when I heard about this bill the other day, it gave me some uneasy feelings. I almost wish that I didn't have these plants ordered, because I have to put these plants in this year, pay for them, and take care of them this year, and I don't get a crop until 78 then, and then I get a crop in 79, and a crop in 80. And to me, it would be a loss to have to go out there next year and work those up, because I just don't see how I could harvest them on a hourly basis. Now, I fully appreciate the concern, probably the concern that's behind this bill, to increase the wage at the lower end of the scale. And I don't think anyone is more concerned about the wide gap in the income among the people of this country. And I'm ready to support any reasonable effort to narrow that gap. I mean, maybe it's going to have to come from both directions, I would be all for it. But I don't see that eliminating jobs is the right answer to it.
Just one thing on mechanization. We have always felt that probably at the age we are, even if the strawberry business is mechanized, we would continue to work with hand harvest. I mean, even if a viable mechanical picker came, for one thing, we feel the quality of berries is still going to be a demand for a very high quality strawberry, and that we would be able to accomplish the demand for that high quality by hand picking, whereas with a mechanized picker, this would be more difficult. I don't know. I think there'll be a few years when there will be no strawberries picked in Oregon. And I also, as a member of the large cooperative cannery, state and cannery, I also worry about the whole cannery operation and what that will do to cannery employees if the strawberry business goes out. Because that is a part, there are cannery employees who have worked during berry harvest when there's nothing else coming in for harvest. And you would, again, increase the amount of unemployment compensation necessary and have decreased the number of weeks when cannery workers are hired. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your attitude and your interest in this whole subject and your concern about a fair wage for pickers.
I appreciate your excellent testimony.
Can we hand out to you a copy of the material that we give to each child, and each child's parent gets this also, so that they know exactly where their child is and where they can call for more information. And I'm sorry my testimony isn't written, but we will type it up and get it to you all.
That'll be fine.
Thank you.
Are there any questions of Mr. and Mrs. Kniggy?
Mr. Chairman, can I make a brief statement about my experiences picking berries?
Oh, gosh. What a memory. That long ago.
Well, I remember in the late 1930s when I picked raspberries for a cent a pound, and then you were given a half-cent bonus at the end of the season. I also remember the 1960s when my three older children were growing up, and I would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to get those kids out to the berry fields. They started at age 10, not 12. Anyway, they started in strawberries, then raspberries, then Marion blackberries, and then Blue Lake beans. And I think it was a good experience for them. I look at the end result. One now has a PhD in developmental biology. One has a master's in political science and public administration, and one has a master's in education. And part of the money that they earned in the berry fields went toward purchase of clothes and also for payment of a college education.
You didn't mention the one that went into politics.
One of the things that we know about the dollars that go to our kids, they get paid at the end of every day. And I used to think that we should wait and pay at the end of the berry picking season also, but we found this to be more practical. But those dollars turn over very, very rapidly. They go into Corvallis, and because a lot of our kids do come from fairly affluent families, those dollars get turned over for school clothing and for records and skis and bicycles. And it is just a really booming economy in June when the strawberry picker money comes in to the record shops.
I might say one thing else, Mr. Chairman, at least with my kids, and I think of the young people in East Multnomah County, that they knew where berry picking conditions were the best, and there was competition among growers to get these kids. And so things were equalized pretty much from the standpoint that if such and such a grower wasn't treating the kids the way the kids felt that they should be treated, there was nothing for those kids to walk off the job and go to the other grower where they could make more money and conditions were better.
Now we don't have, like in our community, we don't have that much competition. The kids don't have that many choices. But the other thing that we have competition with is the kids no longer need the cash quite that much. So therefore, unless you really make that a good work experience for them, they're not going to be there. And that is extremely important. I grew up in western Pennsylvania and married an Oregon farmer, and you can see what's happened. But, Pennsylvania somehow always thinks of itself in some of the eastern states as the eastern liberal establishment and one thing or another. And I just think that Oregon is something else again, in that it has this blend of far-reaching liberal progressive ideas illustrated, by the bottle bill, which is the one that we always think of. But also, in its basic conservatism, it has espoused conservative values that do have far-reaching liberal implications. And I just think that our treatment of kids and their chance to work, like I never had when I was a kid, are fantastic.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now, let's see, the subcommittee will... How about Mike Shelby? Stokely Van Camp. Here? Okay.
I'm Mike Shelby, S-H-E-L-B-Y, representative of Stokely Van Camp Frozen Food Division, Albany, Oregon.
speaking in opposition to House Bill 2654. You've heard a great deal from the growers as far as their concerns about the bill. Our concern is, I'll stay away from the picking end of it. We're looking at it from the processor, the competitive processor position. If this bill, pardon me, does in fact cause additional economic burden on the growers, then in fact it will have a great deal of effect on the processors involved. We're processing a very high quality berry in the Northwest. We're competing directly with California, who have the ability to produce greater volumes of berries, and we're also competing directly with Mexico. And these factors have to be reckoned with. The economic note that I wanted to point out, the Northwest food processors in the valley here, we're faced with a number of uphill battles. Number one, our transportation rates to the markets. And when I say the markets, we're talking a local market somewhat, a California market somewhat, but mainly a Midwest and East Coast market. The transportation rates, we pay the highest rates of anybody in the country to get this finished product to market. We have the highest labor rates in our processing plants of any portion of the United States at the present time. And we are also paying the highest raw product rate. And although when you compare these factors, you add them together, it does put us in somewhat of an economic disadvantage. We are able to overcome this. A great deal of the reason is in our raw product quality. And there is no doubt in any of these farmers' minds, no doubt in our mind, that we are able here in Oregon, because of our environment, because of our good growing conditions, we are able to grow a very high quality product. Stokely's in particular, our berries are all grown in the Albany, Lebanon, Springfield, Eugene, Cottage Grove, Cresswell area. And I would say at the present time, the largest grower we have only runs about 18 acres of berries. All of our fields tend to fall in the range of 8 to 12 acres, in that range. So we're talking primarily about the farmer who's not completely dependent on his berries, but is dependent mostly on neighbor kids. And you've heard some of the people who have talked have been growing for us. And we aren't affected at all, really, by any migrant-type labor, any of the transient labor. We're talking primarily neighbor kids, local children from the or youth from the cities nearby. I think in that respect, if I would imagine, and I can't compare what the other processors are doing, say in Washington County and or in Portland, some of the Salem area processors, but I think if we went to the mandatory or the hourly wage rate on this, because of the nature of the kids we have picking the for our growers, this could cause a real hardship for them. And if it causes, like I say, if it causes a hardship, then it's going to cause a problem for us. And I think the ultimate step would be for us to pull out of the strawberry business in Oregon. We're currently in the berry business in California, and we are here locally personally concerned about staying in the business. It does help our overall economics of our plant. It gives us extends our processing season. It keeps our labor force busy a greater part of the year, and of course utilizes our equipment and helps spread the overhead. If the cost of berries was to increase much here in the valley, or the cost that we have to pay for the raw product, I'm sure that the company then would consider the California market to a greater degree. We also got some berries back in the Midwest, so I'm sure that this is something we'd have to reckon with. A couple other notes. The mechanization has been emphasized a couple of times. If it comes to a mechanized berry harvest, the feeling is at the present time that we would not go in, we would get out of the berry business in Oregon if it went mechanization, primarily because, like I emphasized, we process only a fancy pack, a fancy retail pack, and if you go to mechanical harvest, you've got to have a market for everything you pick. When you mechanical harvest, you get a little bit of everything, and you'd have to have a market for the jams and the syrups and purees, and also a substandard product. And so we're not in that market. We only pack, as I say, a retail, and it's fancy pack. and it primarily all goes to the East Coast. That's where our big market is.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Representative Otto.
You mentioned that your market is primarily on the East Coast. Is that a fresh fruit market or a processed fruit market?
Okay, this is processed. This is all we do,
all right.
Is a processed.
You just processed.
When I say, right. I say a retail pack, I'm talking a 12-ounce
okay.
carton of...
Yeah, right. One other question then. Would it be safe to say that none of the mechanically harvested berries go into the fresh fruit market where they're being retailed in the stores? Would that be a fair statement?
That would definitely be a fair assumption.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
I don't know of any other notes I have. I was in contact with our people in California Friday. I'm rather unprepared for this. I caught it late Friday afternoon before I really discovered I was going to be here, but did contact them in Oxnard, California, where we grow our berries, and they did say, they indicated down there that they do not have any, there is no state control rate for picking at this time in California. They are, all the processed berries, they do plan on picking at a piece rate. They do have some hourly rates down there, but it's primarily, or it's right at the moment, it is strictly into the fresh market berries, the ones you buy fresh in the store. There is some hourly rates on that, but they're processed berries. There are no state controls down there at this time.
Okay, that's all I have. Questions of Mr. Shelby? Yeah. Thank you very much. Walt Lofgren? Well, he's coming up, and I want to assure you people what the chairman has already said, that just because there aren't very many committee members here does not mean much. Every word is being recorded permanently on tape, and that'll be in the state archives.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Walter Lofgren. I am a legislative representative of the Oregon State Council of Hotel and Restaurant Employees and Bartenders International Union. You may wonder why I appear to support the concept of House Bill 2654. In our industry, we are continually concerned with the minimum wage. So that's the reason I'm here. Go forward. And this is a short statement. We support House Bill 2654 for reasons of elimination of all piecework systems, whether it be in the factories or the fields. The piecework system has no really justifiable arguments for its continuance. We can talk about providing jobs for young workers and this and that. But this system is outmoded, whether the proponents like it or not. When the opponents finally recognize that there will be no more piecework in the fields and thusly pay an hourly wage consistent with the economic needs of the average worker, we can then move forward in providing the necessary personnel to harvest the crops. And I think that's what the argument's all about. We do not support the elimination of job opportunities for the young workers. In fact, we endorse it. We simply say their economic opportunity should be on a par with the other workers. House Bill 2654 assists in that concept, so it deserves our support. End of the statement. And that's our position.
Thank you, Mr. Lofgren. Is there any other questions of Mr. Lofgren? Thank you, Walter. I appreciate it. Mr. George Stevens?
Mr. Chairman, I'm George Stevens, representing the Oregon State Grange. Most of everything I have here has already been said, and so I won't go deeply into it. And there are copies of my presentation. But there are just a couple of points that I wish to emphasize. The Grange is in opposition to this bill. In opposing this bill, I in no way try to return the House of Labor to the conditions of the 1920s I do, however, feel that the circumstances in each of these cases deal with a different set of conditions. And then I eliminate the rest of it, and I go down two-thirds down the page. The people that worry me and for whom I am concerned are our younger citizens. I have had many of them ask if there wasn't something that could be done so that they could get work. They are quite aware that as an apprentice, they could not expect to go out without any experience and demand the present salaries. So these are not productive, but only hoping. And then I go on down farther, and I say, if I were going to do anything to this bill except deep six it, I would start with section 3, line 15, and delete the words shall receive not less than, then add this amendment. Being at least 12 years of age shall be allowed to work in the harvesting of row crops, including but not limited to berries, string beans, and other row crops, but shall not be required to lift more than 25 pounds until the age 18. And we'll stop at that.
Okay. Are there any questions of Mr. Stevens? Mr. Stevens has done it basically eliminate the minimum wage. Thank you, George. I appreciate you coming. Mr. Paul Walden.
I guess that's yours.
Yeah. With your opening statement, I'm not quite sure whether I say Your Honor or Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Mr. Walden. I should have never said
that. It's okay for him to approach the bench.
Well, yes. For the record, I am Paul Walden, representing the tree fruit growers of Wasco, Hood River, and Jackson counties. I was not really prepared to testify today, except spring work is on, I hope you recognize, on the farms, and they asked me to say a few words. I would like to state, first of all, that it is certainly my belief, and I'm sure that the people I represent share this, that the minimum wage here is not the issue with our group. The issue is the problem of handling a minimum wage, relating it to piecework in the field. I grew up on an orchard at Milton Freewater, and for 10 years in Wasco County, owned and operated 80 acres of cherries. And I might relate to you some of the problems that I see with this particular bill if you try to put a minimum wage on piece rates. In the cherry business in Wasco County, the pickers, as has been related here earlier by a previous witness, would usually hit the orchard right after daylight because the cherries were far easier to pick when it was cool. And they would sometimes then leave the field and come down and have coffee or maybe breakfast at 10 or so, sit around their picking camp for a while, go back in the orchard, and usually quit 3 or 3:30 in the afternoon when it was very hot, and occasionally go back later in the evening and pick for a while when it was cool again. And this was fine with us as the owners of the orchard. They could come and go as they pleased. Now, if you apply a minimum wage, I don't know exactly how you do this, because you're going to have to keep track of the time they arrive in the field, and are they actually picking when they're in the field, or, as happened occasionally, they would stop and have lunch in the middle of the morning, again at noon, or coffee. And this was fine. We had a very fine relationship. And I really don't know how, if you apply a minimum wage to piece rates, you can physically handle the problem in an orchard such as I was running at that time, or owning. One of the other problems that I see with it is that we had lots of family units. I had mostly migrants. Some came from town. Children of all ages were working in the fields, generally not very long, because they would get tired and rather play than work, and this was fine with us too. The general situation in my orchard anyway was that the families would let the children pick the bottoms of the trees in their row where they could reach them from the ground. And then the father and the mother and perhaps the older children would get on the ladders and finish off the trees. This meant that some of the very younger, or the younger than some of the others, were maybe working an hour or so out of 4 or maybe 2 hours in a day, and the rest of the time played or did their things. This would totally, as I view it, eliminate having those types of people in the orchard. The other problem that I see with it is a problem we got into in Hood River County last fall when we were trying to get the pear crop picked. We had a large crop, and I think most of you recognize the fact that in all fruit crops and vegetables for that matter, there is a very tight time frame during which you must get the crop off. They do a pressure test on pears, and when the pressure of the repair is to a certain point. And what this pressure test consists of is a mechanical plunger device with a meter that shows pounds of pressure applied, and when they can penetrate the skin of the pear with, say, 12 pounds of pressure, the pear is ready to pick. And you better jolly well get it off the trees rather rapidly. We ran into a picker shortage, and they actually allowed any of the students in the high school to get out of school and help the farmers get the crop off. And there were many, many of them that did this. I have no idea how much per hour on piecework these young people made. To them, it was a means of getting out of school, perhaps more than the money. But we got the job done. And again, under this provision of this bill, the farmer would have to have checked these people in, made sure they were picking, not playing, and make sure that they made at least the minimum wage. Again, Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee, the people I represent are not so concerned with the minimum wage as the mechanics of trying to apply it to the piece worker in the field. Thank you very much.
Any questions of Mr. Walden? Thank you, Paul. Mr. Mike Dewey? Mr. Dewey has another hearing. Mr. Dewey is the representative of the Oregon Wheat League, and he told me before the hearing that if he were here and not in another meeting, that he would testify in opposition to this particular bill. That's the last name I have on the list for people who want to testify. Is there anyone else that wants to? Yes, sir. Would you please come on up and state your name?
My name is Albert Green. I live in Portland, Oregon. My address is 1634 Northeast Saratoga. I would like to ask some questions, I suppose. The question that is foremost in my mind, this minimum wage bill, would it apply statewide to all young people? That's the question I'm asking, I guess.
Mr. Green, there's another statute, and I think most of the witnesses have picked it out. Do you have the copy of the bill right there? Is it up there? I can show it where it's at, where they're talking about.
I know. I understand 2654, but I'm asking a specific question for a specific reason.
Okay. Let me put it this way. The section that everyone is talking about is section one of the bill that says repeals ORS 653020 and ORS 653022. If you read those two sections of the statute, they have the exclusions to the state minimum wage law. And if those are repealed, that would mean there are no exclusions to the state minimum wage law. Therefore, the state minimum wage law would apply to everyone over 18 years of age.
Everyone over 18?
Yes. Now, what has happened, though, and I think this is what most of the people are aware of, is the Labor Commissioner this last fall, through its administrative rulings, which it's entitled to do under the statute, promulgated an administrative rule that basically said that those under 18 would be subject to the minimum wage, that the rate would be $2.30 an hour, which is the same as the minimum wage law. Now, there are also some exclusions from that, but that's the general framework of what they're talking about.
Well, I came here representing an organization known as Committee for Progress Through Law, and I came here to support the bill from CPL. Mm-hmm. But as a private citizen, I had talked with my son, and my son voiced a very real concern. He said, if they raise the minimum wage for children, this means that the number of hours I would be allowed to work would be lowered, because on, you know, the summer programs in the city, they are allowed, say, X number of dollars, say $500 or $600 during the summer. Okay, if the wage was raised, say, to $250 or $230, whatever it is, he would not be allowed to work the maximum number of hours. As of now, I think they're allowed to work 240 hours. If the funds aren't increased, you know, for the wage fund, the number of hours they could make to get the same number of dollars that they would get working 240 hours, you know, So this was his concern, that he would not be able to work the 240 hours before he would have to stop work during the summer.
Okay.
Now, like I said, when I came here to support 2654, House Bill 2654. But now my emotions are kind of mixed. I mean, because this was a valid concern of the child. He's 15, so...
I think that most of the testimonies you've heard this morning has been along the same line, that most people are concerned of what the impact upon minors would be if this bill would pass. Let me tell you that the bill does not raise the minimum wage in the state. What it does is it makes a large number of individuals who are presently excluded from the minimum wage covered by the minimum wage of the state, which is $2.30 an hour. And I think that those two sections I said that are being repealed are the ones that basically tell you who's covered. Now, I don't know where your son falls into that. I don't, you know, I just looking. Well, there's an exclusion for an individual employed by the United States or this state or a political subdivision or quasi-municipal corporation thereof. Now, I don't know if your son is working for the...
Let's see. Summer Work Program. I have forgotten the exact name of it. I shouldn't have.
Mr. Ward, can you answer Mr. Green's concern about the number of hours? Could you do that with him? Mr. Ward behind you is the Assistant Commissioner of Labor, and he could probably address your concern much better than I can. Would you do that, Mr. Ward? I appreciate it very much. Thank you, Mr. Green. Since there's no one else on the list on House Bill 2654, I'm going to close the hearing on that particular bill. I'd like the record to show that I was contacted by a gentleman from Electrolux Corporation, and he was unable to be here today, but he came in from the east last week, and he has told me that they are opposed to House Bill 2654. The hearing's closed on 2654. The next bill that I'd like to bring up would be in 2682. Mr. Frederick?
Thank you, Your Majesty.
Carl understands the process very well.
Which bill are we on?
My name is Carl Frederick. I'm Employee Benefits Director for Associated Oregon Industries, and I would like to speak in support of House Bill 2682. In support of it with some amendments, which I'll allude to a little later. Actually, this bill is a rather modest attempt to increase work opportunities for minors under 18 years of age. In December of 1975, the Oregon Wage and Hour Commission, not the Commissioner of Labor, raised the minimum wage for minors from $1.75 an hour to two.
Just a second. People, would you, if you have a concern, would you go out in the hall? Because and you want to talk to them there. If Mr. Lofgren wants to come out there. Okay. Now would somebody like to go out and referee?
Sounds more interesting than what I'm going to be talking about.
I am. I'm almost tempted to recess and go out and listen to it. Go ahead, Carl. I'm sorry.
All right. Actually,
would
December,
you close the doors, please?
Fire the door. Is that feedback?
Go ahead, Carl.
It's your heavy breathing.
It's not I. It started before I arrived.
Go ahead, Carl.
All right. In December of 1975, the Oregon Wage and Hour Commission raised the minimum wage for minors from $1.75 an hour to $2.10 immediately, and then to it went to $2.30 an hour as of January 1st, 1976. That's where it is today. And under the Wage and Hour Commission's rule, the minimum wage for minors shall automatically increase to a rate equal to the increase in the statutory Oregon minimum wage for adults on the effective date of each increase. At that time, shortly thereafter, we petitioned the Wage and Hour Commission to modify the rule permitting an entry-level minimum wage for minors for a period not to exceed 120 days. However, our petition fell on deaf ears and it was soundly rejected. So shortly after the session began, I contacted the Representative Brad Morris, and he agreed to introduce a bill expressing what we had attempted to do through the petition route through the Wage and Hour Commission, and that's what House Bill 2682 is. I suspect that the opponents against reducing the minimum wage for minors will be probably express three different objections. One, maintaining a different minimum wage for minors and adults is discriminatory. It makes minors second-class citizens. Second argument we usually hear, if minors do the same work as adults, shouldn't they be paid the same? And three, minors have to pay the same price for goods as adults, so they should receive the same pay. I'd like to kind of review these items very briefly because I realize we're running out of time and perhaps give you a different perspective. Maintaining a different minimum wage for minors and adults is discriminatory and makes minors second-class citizens. Let's deal with that first. Federal, state, and local laws recognize at the present time that minors should be treated differently than adults in a variety of ways. As a matter of fact, the Wage and Hour Commission itself is directed by Oregon statute to do so, and in fact, has adopted rules in the past relating to the prohibition of minors from engaging in certain hazardous employment. And without a doubt, this is discriminatory. However, I submit that it may be desirable and necessary to discriminate in some of these instances. Also, the commission regulates, in part, the working hours of minors, and minors who are required under the law to be paid the same minimum wage as adults, I might point out. Now, other laws differentiate between minors and adults, and these include special courts for minors, schooling requirements, drinking prohibition, and the basic right to vote. And there are no doubt many reasons for such differentiation because of age, but some obvious ones are maturity and experience. And minors through 17 usually lack both, and frankly need the protection of the government in many ways. And this protection is provided. And I feel a job opportunity is the same. If a difference in the minimum wage protects job opportunities for minors that they might otherwise lose, then the charge of discrimination is as inappropriate as it is in all other recognized and established differentiations. Now, the second argument is that if minors do the same work as adults, shouldn't they be paid the same? Now, it's not the intent of this bill to prevent minors from being paid at the same rate as adults. The proposal is an entry-level wage, 85% or $1.95. It's not a limit. It's only a minimum wage. And we were told at the prior hearing that by an employer that minors are generally more expensive to train for a particular job than adults because most adults have had some work experience and are more mature. Additionally, minors are usually hired at hours convenient to them because of certain school requirements, football games, dances, and so forth. The adults are expected to work at hours convenient to the needs of the employer and his customers. And remember that the law is much more restrictive in limiting the work of minors as contrasted to the law pertaining to the employment of adults. Very briefly, the argument minors have to pay the same prices for goods, so they should receive the same pay. With very few exceptions, minors under 18 are not the sole support of families. They don't have to buy the food for children, pay life insurance, mortgage or rent payments, oil or utility bills, and so forth. So we're not talking about a major breadwinner in a family. The amendments I would suggest to the committee would be, because actually this bill doesn't do anything that the Wage and Hour Commission can't do.
I was just
going
to ask you that. Yeah. It appeared to
something
me
was lost in the translation when they asked for
it. May has to be changed to shall.
I would change that. I would suggest that on line 13, eliminate the phrase "the commission to the extent necessary," and then on line 14 change the may to a shall, and probably take out on line 16 or $1.95 an hour, so that the amendment would read, to prevent curtailment of opportunities for youth employment, the commission shall provide by rule for employment of minors under 18 years of age at a wage rate not less than 85% of their wage rate in ORS 653.025. And then I'll take out whichever is higher. And any reduction of the minimum wage under this subsection shall not be authorized 120 days after the date of hiring of the minor.
What is the intent of that last sentence? I just don't understand it, Carl.
The 120 day? The entry level, so that it isn't a permanent period. This is the argument that I can take that out too.
No, I see what you're saying.
Be delighted.
I guess the thing is, I was reading it, and I couldn't understand what you're trying to get at.
Yeah.
And what you were...
It's a limited period of time,
okay.
And that particular date, I don't have any particular reason for it. Other than talking to the fast food people, they indicated that's a good training period.
Yes.
Just for clarification, should the word after be between the authorized and 120?
You lost me.
Well, the last sentence, any reduction of the minimum wage rate under this subsection shall not be authorized 120 days. I think that it would make a little more sense if the word after was inserted.
For a period not exceeding 120 or something
along that
line.
Something like that. I'm not enthusiastic about the grammatical.
Yeah, I'm not.
That's an awful cumbersome way to say.
That can be cleaned up.
Yeah. So. One other quick comment. I picked up a copy of U.S. News and World Report, and it was an interview with the Nobel Prize winner Milt Friedman, and I was interested in one of the answers to his question. Has the government done anything to help teenagers who have the highest rate of unemployment? I think they were alluding to black teenagers at the particular time. But anyway, he indicates in his long answer, without the minimum wage law, the least skilled could offer to work for low wages, which would provide an incentive for employers to hire and train them. It has always been a mystery to me why a teenager is better off unemployed at $2.30 an hour rather than employed at, say, $2 an hour. End of quote.
Dr. Friedman
After
has always been
Nobel
a mystery
Prize.
To me, believe me. Many of his economic policies.
I don't have any statistics on the effect of this. I presume the Bureau of Labor will come up with... I think there's something like 40 to 50,000 teenagers that would fall into this bracket, and undoubtedly he'll have figures to show that so many certificates were offered for a given period of time. All I know is that I'm from a small town, Silverton. It's awfully tough to find work other than in the fields or working at their canneries. But if the kids are under 16, they have to depend on the local retailers, and I talked to a number of them. And quite frankly, they said it's dried up as far as hiring teenagers. That our local school superintendent made the same statement. He just can't get jobs anymore. So it's a problem.
Chairman? Are you saying that you don't have any statistics on the number of jobs that dried up after the Wage and Hour Commission made its report?
I haven't. I have a statement that was made by, I think it was the Employment Division, Chairman. I hope I have it here. Shortly after the proposal for the minimum wage increase went into effect. Yes, it was from the Employment Division. It was their monthly bulletin, I guess. Anyway, they said, recent changes in the minimum wage structure will undoubtedly adversely affect to some degree the employment of youths under 18 during 1976. Effective January 1st, 1976, minimum wage for minors in the state of Oregon was raised to $2.30 an hour. It is lawful for some employers to pay an adult $2.20 per hour on the same rate. The $2.30 per hour wage itself means fewer youths will be hired than would be at a lesser rate. This presents a distinct challenge to youth placement activities. And this is your Employment Division article by Ross Morgan.
Representative Starr?
The person that testified before on this bill, I think it was just one that hired some youngsters in the restaurant business.
Right.
And he said that they worked pretty steady and that he did retain them after what would be 120 days
right.
He would normally, because he trained them well and they did just what he wanted them to do. But does this 120 days mean just exactly what it says? That's calendar days. I was thinking of a part-time person that worked just a day or two a week. 120 days later, the person probably wouldn't be trained. I mean, you know, to the degree that he would if he or she worked full-time.
Yeah, my intent was to make it a flat 120 days.
Mm-hmm. Just 120 days later,
regardless of how many days that individual worked.
Yeah, period. Okay.
It's just flat. And as I say, I'm not...
Well, that's what it says here.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Sure, that's what... Yeah, okay, fine.
Carl, my only concern about it is that it appears to me that, and I recall the last past legislative sessions, that the philosophy of the legislature has been that the state would regulate the minimum wage of those over 18 years of age by statute.
That's right.
And the Wage and Hour Commission would regulate the minimum wage or the payment of wages of those under 18. And it appeared to me to be a express legislative policy that that's the way we were going to do it. And I see this bill, and I'm not passing on the merits of it. I'm just saying that this bill seems to be a major change in that intent, in that we're not going to give the Wage and Hour Commission that authority. Now, they may have brought this on themselves by the action they took or their lack of ability to respond to a number of concerns that the business community had. But I want you to know, in that light, that's what bothers me, because I really feel that if we do this, we're going to just be opening up the door to next session and the session after that to further limit the power. And if we're going to do that, I would rather look at the other side of it and just go and establish statutorily a rate for minors and not give the Wage and Hour Commission that much leeway, that's what we're going
to do. Of course, this is a decision you'll have to make, whether you want to advocate your statutory or your legislative authority to the Wage and Hour Commission. And there's no mystery about it. This is a clear attempt on my part to circumvent the Wage and Hour Commission in this area. And this didn't come from last session, incidentally. They've had this authority for some time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this has been what
there was an attempt last session to eliminate the Wage and Hour Commission itself, George.
I remember.
I wouldn't be averse to that and have the legislature take back this authority.
No, as long as we understand each other.
You understand where I'm coming from, sir?
Oh, no, I do very well. Thank you, Carl.
You're welcome.
Mr. Howard Fuji.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. We're getting close to the bewitching hour. 5 minutes?
Mr. Chairman, I would also suggest that you do not believe what Representative Starr might say as to when the session begins.
I've already...
We checked it out, Representative Otto. I would not rely upon his assertion.
I served notice on him that we'd go by this, not the little notes that I carry.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Howard Fuji, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation, and I certainly endorse the statements that made by Mr. Frederick's relative to the need for this change. And I might suggest that you might look at a further amendment that because the minimum wage schedule for agriculture is a different schedule than is given in 653025, it is 653029. And this is a minimum wage that's uniform with the federal act, and it's different from the regular minimum wage in that for 1977 the minimum wage is $2.20, and for after December 31st, 77 it's $2.30. So possibly using the percentage figure that's in the bill and just amending the bill by adding after 653025, 653029, and 653029.
Okay.
And that would, I think, provide and make it uniform and in consideration of minimum wage for agriculture. And we believe that this would be highly desirable, strictly from the standpoint of providing more opportunity for youth employment. Generally, farmers figure that if a boy can do a man's job, you pay him a man's pay. But this, again, is an entry-level situation, and I think that if the youth could learn a job and do the job, why, he would probably get his rate increase prior to the 120 days, but I think the 120 days would be desirable in this situation, because it is gives a learning period for getting acquainted with the job and being able to do the job.
Thank you, Howard. Are any questions? None. Yeah. Howard, I know you're signed up on House Bill 2800, and that's another, but I think I'd just soon try to get through this one again.
Yes, we would support the concept of House Bill 2800 for the high school dropout, because actually that's what the what the language in 339030, the exemptions there are just exemptions from compulsory school attendance for a number of reasons. And we feel that such an individual that is a high school dropout is much better off working at a job at whatever he can earn rather than being excluded from the job because of the minimum wage situation.
Thank you very much. Dale, if you want to come up here, we're going to have to be very quick. I have a number of questions that I had about the decision of the Wage and Hour Commission last time, the decision it made and its impact. It's, the session's starting right now.
Mr. Chairman, I'm really here at your pleasure. I could give you some background on the Wage and Hour Commission or answer any questions you have, and I'd be happy to come back if you want.
Could you do that? Because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding among exactly what it did and what it didn't do and everything. So I would just soon have you come back and give us a presentation on that at a later time. Would you? Thank you. I'd like to read into the record at this time a letter that I received from the Lane County Labor Council, AFL-CIO. We are strongly opposed to House Bills 2682 and 2800 and any other bill attempting an exception to the minimum wage law for minors, which are in your committee. We support House Bill 2654, signed sincerely, Irvin H. Fletcher, Executive Secretary. I just wanted to get that in. He asked me to put that into the record. Hearing, anything else coming forward, committee? Hearing none, committee's adjourned.
House Labor Committee.
Putting some penalty on now when they overcome.
Yeah. Public hearing March 23rd. Table 11, side 2.
It's just a monstrosity because.
Come to order. The clerk will note those presents. All others are excused. I'm glad to see that the people who have just as much difficulty getting up and being here at 8 o'clock are not only the members of the committee. I'm going to try and take the bills in order, and the first one up today is 2651. Which is a bill that I have introduced, and I'm glad to see that Mr. Gill came over to testify about my bill. Chuck, why don't you come on up?
Did you want a motion at this time, Mr. Chairman?
Which one of us would you like to recognize?
Go ahead, Chuck.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Chuck Gill. I'm the manager of SAFE. I'm very much aware of the bill and interested in it. And I thought I would come this morning and just to maybe share with you how a number of other state funds operate. There are some that do have boards or directors over them. They're organized considerably different than we are here in Oregon. In those cases where there are boards or directors or they usually have unique kind of freedoms or responsibilities, primarily in the budgetary area where they do not have their budget reviewed by the legislature, and they usually are involved in investing their own funds. One of the primary activities of that board is to advise on the investment of the funds themselves. In Oregon, of course, we are reviewed and controlled budgetary-wise in a number of other ways by the legislature, who acts as a policy-making body, in a sense, as to our activities. Our investments are done by the state treasurer, with all the resources that he has available. There are certain direction that on a day-to-day basis that's given directly by the governor's office as to our activity. I would suppose that just general overview is how we operate, and if there is some concern about that, I'm here to respond to any particular questions.
Chuck, I'm going to be very truthful. I don't know if it's because of the early hour that there's no one else here, but I know that there's considerable interest in this idea, and the people that I know that have asked me to introduce the bill and look at it are not here right now. I'm going to set the bill for another hearing after today. I may set it further down the agenda. That was my fault at 8 o'clock in the morning because I guess for some reason
I think 8 o'clock is a very good time.
Oh, I have noticed that, and I have just learned a very important factor in setting the agenda, which bills I want on first. Does anyone else have any questions?
I have a considerable number. Is SAIF basically an insurance company?
Yes, I'd say it could be defined as a type of mutual insurance company run by the state.
Okay. How would you rank it in size as to some other of our domestic insurers in this state?
Well, it's very hard to compare with domestic insurers. There aren't any in the same business that are domestic.
But I mean, premium-wise, or assets, whatever measure we wanted to use, you should be able to should have some idea.
From the carriers that we compete with, of course, we generate a lot more premium than any of our other counterparts. We probably generate between 50% and 60% of the premium in the state.
In workman's compensation.
In workman's compensation, yes.
So, all right. This calls for a meeting, commission to meet at least once every 3 months. In an operation of this size, is that a realistic time frame for a body that's going to be setting policy for?
It also gives them the authority, as I read the bill, to call themselves into session at any time they'd wish. The normal procedure is for a mandatory meeting at least every 3 months in most of the boards that are in force. So I think that's probably a reasonable time frame. I suppose it depends upon what's interpreted as policy as to how involved they get.
I was going to ask that question next when I come to it. So how often do you think that it would be necessary for a policy-making board to meet?
Well, Representative Rogers, it's very difficult. I would say if they want to set the general guidelines of policy for the operation without getting into the day-to-day activity, once a quarter is probably more than enough. All of our policy is written and documented and on all of our activities, and it's a matter, I suppose, of approving all of that. And once that's approved, I suppose it's a matter of monitoring to see that it does take place, and evaluating the business on a quarterly basis seems to be a reasonable period of time.
Now, it says on line 30 of page 2, it is a function of the commission to establish the policies for the operation consistent with all applicable provisions of law. How much of your policy is established directly by the legislature now, as opposed to the policy adopted within SAIF?
Well, the policy established by the legislature is directed in a couple of ways. One, the law itself that prescribes certain responsibilities to be carried out, and they're very general in nature, advising that we should participate actively in the workman's compensation field. The budgetary process is probably a more direct policy guidance in the program area, and by that they establish what they anticipate for us to do during a biennium by the granting of positions and monies for specific programs.
So the legislative policy that has been developed, as is usual, is quite broad, and within that framework you have adopted the working policy.
Yes, yes, sir.
All right. Now, if we have some kind of a commission like this established, and I don't know what the motive behind it is, apparently it would be with the idea of them changing some policy. And that would then have to be the working policy within those broader frameworks.
I would assume that that would be the intent, and I'm kind of confounded by what they anticipate the legislature to do if they're going to change policy. Are they going to set the policy, or is the legislature going to set the policy? Or, for that matter, on the day-to-day basis, are they going to replace the governor from setting types of policy that he's involved in, the direct administration? We are, so one other thing I might point out, we also are audited by the Secretary of State, obviously, in both the fiscal audit and in areas of performance audit in relationship to that policy. And we're also audited by the insurance company from a policy of reserves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In Section 4, it goes into, it makes some changes. Right now, the law says the manager is appointed by the governor, subject to the normal confirmation, and the manager has the direct supervision. But then this would change it to the commission appointing the manager, but the commission appointed by the governor and serving at his pleasure. Now, we have different boards and commissions now in the state that have that work this way and some other ways. You see, what do you see as a possible problem in that, or is it less of a problem than the current system?
Well, I would think that, in my opinion, that the control of appointment and approval by appointment by the governor, approval by the Senate, is certainly less of a problem than might take place with a commission. Certainly more of a review. But I'm not saying it can't work the other way, but this is a normal procedure in state government. And
okay, right now, you are directly under the control of the governor?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So, is there any problem with the policy, the policies that you have operated under as related to the governor?
Certainly no problems. The governor reviews those, and I meet with him on a regular basis at least once a month in staff meetings. It's a very, very effective way, as far as I'm concerned, to keep him advised and he to keep me advised of those areas that we should mutually be concerned about.
So the current law implies that he has some control over the policy that you might adopt. If you adopt a policy that's not in accordance with his...
Yes, sir. He's my boss.
Okay. So now it comes on down to line 13 on page 3. It says, now it adds the word subject to the policy direction by the commission. And I see that as just interposing another layer in here, because the commission is going to be subject to the governor. And then if you were retained and you were in the position as manager, you would be subject to the wishes of the commission.
I agree with you, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Question? Under the supervision of the governor, he's probably got somebody else doing it anyway, rather than just the governor himself. It would be someone in his staff, or some one or more person.
Yes, the governor has areas of responsibility assigned to staff personnel. However, there is direct contact with the governor on both reporting by me and on areas of question that he's interested in, and he does meet with the staff very frequently.
What Chuck? What kind of assets do you generally have? I mean, it would fluctuate some, but in a year's time, I was just wondering what the assets were in the fund and what the return.
Well, there's a
Chuck. Let me ask you a question before you get into this. I imagine that you're planning to make a presentation before the full committee at some particular time when the workman's compensation legislation comes over here. I think that's what you've done before. I always remember your graphs and charts and everything else.
Well, there are several bills that speak in other areas of our operation that...
Here's what I'd like to do, is if it's possible, if Representative Starr would agree, if at some particular time I would like the fund to make a presentation to the full committee as to many of the questions that I think you're being asked today.
Very good.
I think that you weren't prepared to answer questions in that area, and I would like you to, we could set a time up on the agenda to do that, and if the committee wanted to take a tour of your quarters, that'd be fine with me. I have no problem, but I would like you to make a full presentation to the committee, and
something
you've done
that
in past sessions.
Yeah, I'd enjoy doing that. It might be very helpful to the committee in order for them to frame their questions.
Helpful to me. Okay. Would that be okay?
That would be very good. And
why don't I do this? When I, the next agenda that's set up, I'll try to put a time in there that we'll do that.
Very good.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rogers.
Since we're kind of floundering around in the dark, since I had expected to hear someone come in and support this particular
bill. I support this bill.
Could you tell me what they...
I hate to speak for other people, but I'll tell you. I do not think that the intent of the bill is to set policy over the fund. I think that the bill is more as an attempt to take, to spread the authority or the power of the fund over an appointed commission rather than Mr. Gill, very truthfully. I think that my concern is, and I'll just say this, that as you probably know, that Mr. Gill this past January effectuated a transfer of attorneys or within the system of workman's comp with the Attorney General's office. And that is that the workman's comp attorneys who have generally been independent of the AG's office in the sense that they've generally been viewed as working for the board are now going to be under the Attorney General Justice Department. Mr. Gill has approximately, as I understand, 14 attorneys that were assigned by the Justice Department to the State Accident Insurance Fund. And always, he, in essence, has not had his legal own independent legal counsel, if I may use that phrase, apart from the fund, I mean from the AG's office. Mr. Redden has now decided that he's going to switch the order of where the attorneys are coming from, and Mr. Gill is picking up his house lawyers now, and they're going to be housed with him. And there was a concern on a number of people that with that particular function, in picking that up, that maybe there should be a review of whether the fund itself should be having a broad-based five-member board of citizens in there, looking at Mr. Gill, not so much trying to effectuate, change the policy of the legislature or anything, but to just see how the fund is run. It's an insurance company, you're right. It's absolutely correct, and I have a concern that if it is an insurance company and it's competing, and it does have the percentage of the coverage that it does in the state, because we're mandating all the public employees be covered, that there should be more input from the administrative aspect than Mr. Gill. Now, the answer is that the governor does that. He reports directly to the governor. I think there are a number of people who would feel more comfortable if there was a broader group of people other than Mr. Gill and the governor. Is that blunt?
I'm sorry, I missed the point on the attorney situation.
Well, it's just the fact that now that is an arm of any administration that I think that most of us recognize, that if you are able to have your own independent legal counsel, that gives you a certain degree of flexibility and much more latitude to implement what you want to do without having to check with anyone else. And I think, my own personal opinion, I think it's a good move. That's my own personal opinion. But with that, I'm also concerned that the only person there, Chuck, is you.
Yes, I can appreciate that. I also can be removed rather rapidly also.
I don't think that there's anyone making any assertions about you personally. I think it's just the fact that since the situation is now as it is with your own attorneys, that they're thinking the people were concerned that there be a broader base of input from the top down to the bottom. Okay? Thank you. I appreciate it, Chuck. I'm going to set that for a hearing again. What I'd like to do is that meeting that we're talking about having set up with you making a presentation, if I could ask you now that it would just be a presentation on the functions and the of the fund and the questions that you were getting today concerning the assets, percent of coverage, your reserve accounts.
I think I understand.
How many buildings you own on the Capitol Mall and things like that.
A lot of stuff. I'll hand it down to our
big also. Thanks, Chuck. I appreciate it. The next bill up today is House Bill 2669. Mr. Ray Miller. Mr. Miller, I know you and Mr. Brown are both from Washington County. Do you want to come up together? Please.
2425.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm Ray Miller. I'm chairman of the Board of Commissioners for Washington County, and Ryan Brown is our personnel officer. I always come very long to answer the questions when you start asking the questions. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2669. Washington County is one of the five Oregon counties to adopt a home rule charter. Following the Court of Appeals decision involving the city of Hermiston, we began to develop a local ordinance to cover employee relations for the county. Our problem was somewhat unique in that the Board of Commissioners are also the Board of Directors of the Unified Sewerage Agency, a special district for which the state collective bargaining law still applies. It was therefore important for us to provide as much continuity as possible between our local ordinance and the rules and procedures governing the Unified Sewerage Agency. House Bill 2669 can provide us with the opportunity to keep our procedures consistent in the county and the Unified Sewerage Agency. House Bill 2669 would provide the option for the county to adopt the state collective bargaining law as a whole by declaring ourselves a public employer. The Board of Commissioners would seriously consider this option if it were available, because it would then provide identical procedures throughout our organization. House Bill 2669 would provide the county with another equally important option. When reviewing the alternatives available in writing our local ordinance, we found that the services provided by the Employment Relation Boards were difficult to replace. House Bill 2669 would allow the county to write a local ordinance which could meet the needs of our particular situation and still continue the services provided by the Employment Relations Board. The continuity of our local ordinance and the procedures governing the Unified Sewerage Agency could be maintained by having this option available. Washington County supports House Bill 2669 because it provides the home rule communities with the ability to choose to follow the state collective bargaining law. The bill also allows those communities who have special problems to pay for the services of the Employment Relations Board while still addressing their special needs.
Any questions, Mr. Miller?
Yes.
Representative Chairman. Rogers.
Mr. Miller, you may not be able to answer this, but perhaps Mr. Brown can. Under the ERB, it has more function than just supervision of public employee collective bargaining. And my understanding is that it has jurisdiction over certain other collective bargaining situations where they're not covered by NLRB. Am I correct on that?
I'm not sure I understand the question completely. Hmm.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Can you answer that question?
Why don't you ask me again, more directly?
All right. The ERB has other functions than just supervising the state collective bargaining law for public employees. Am I correct on that?
Yes, you are correct.
Now, is it any bargaining agreement that is not covered under NLRB that they have the jurisdiction over?
If you look at Chapter 663 of the Oregon Revised Statutes, there's an exemption in there. Let me go back one. The state adopted what they called a little NLRA.
Mm-hmm.
And what it attempted to do was to pick up those employees who are not covered by the National Labor Relations Act.
Okay. Now,
and they meet all the jurisdictional requirements.
I know that this probably comes about because of what I consider a screwball decision on the Attorney General's part or somebody's part. Recently it says that they, due to this Hermiston ruling, they can't step in now on these certain things. Why couldn't they come in anyway under that particular provision? You mean
I'm not an attorney.
You mean the counties come in now?
Well, no. Under the ERB, if they've got a dispute, why can't they?
Representative Rogers, I might tell you that when this bill was in, I've requested an opinion of the Attorney General's office. If I might be able to get this thing on and put it in perspective to you, what happened with the Hermiston decision? Mr. Cleveland is here from the Employment Relations Board, and he became concerned as the board as to what procedure they would use to those cities and counties that wanted to utilize the services of the Employment Relations Board. It wasn't even, as my understanding, it was not an opinion request. It was just an inquiry of one of the attorney generals, and it happened to have been in a letter form to Mr. Gillette, who was the Solicitor General, who argued the case for the Employment Relations Board. Mr. Gillette came back in a letter, it was not an opinion request at all, stating that he did not think that the ERB could handle those matters. Now, I take a contrary opinion, because I happen to believe, it's just what you're hitting at, inherent within the concept of home rule is the ability of the county of Washington County to say, we want you people to handle this. And I think that you can do that. In fact, a number of cities and counties, home rule cities and counties, have already ordinances that have done exactly what you're saying. And the ERB is just caught in a position because they do not have a formal opinion. I have requested that opinion of the Attorney General. And I happen to believe that he's going to rule that you have the authority to do that already. You don't need the statute. Now, one other factor in this whole thing is the bill's a little bit premature because no one yet knows what the Supreme Court's going to do with the Hermiston decision. They still have it on, they have not granted review yet, and it may very well be that before the session's over, we're arguing about a problem that doesn't exist. Now, you know, it's interesting to me, and, you know, we've had a decision out of Troutdale yesterday, on the building code, with one of the judges saying that the building code was not a matter of statewide concern, but we've got this battle with the building code now, we've got the land use, and we've got collective bargaining that are all in question, but we've now declared that bingo is a matter of statewide concern. And I think we got our priorities mixed up on this whole thing, and I don't understand it. So I want you to know first, there is an opinion going to be coming from the Attorney General on this specific question. So the bill may not be needed. And I'm hoping that that because it's my understanding that if the Attorney General rules that they do have the authority, the Employment Relations Board is bound by the opinion of the Attorney General to take jurisdiction over those matters.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I apologize for not being a learned attorney.
No.
And knowing the answers to all these things, but it just looked like a dumb opinion to me.
I think it was. It was.
Thank you.
Mr. Burkett.
Good morning. Perhaps the
Steve, could you state your name for the tape so that they'll know
Steve Burkett, assistant to the city manager in Corvallis. Perhaps the explanation by the chairman could resolve some of these things, but he explained the problem, and I suspect we'll have to wait and see what happens, and it could be that this legislation may be unnecessary. But I am here today representing the mayor and city council of Corvallis, urging your favorable recommendation on this House Bill 2669. The city under this proposal would be a contracting public employer because we have adopted an ordinance of our own which provides for administration by the Employment Relations Board, as the chairman mentioned. As he mentioned, the Attorney General has ruled that the Employment Relations Board cannot provide us any service because we're a home rule city with our own ordinance. This does leave a void in our ordinance since it provides that unfair labor practice complaints, representation questions, and mediation services would be handled by the Employment Relations Board. The only alternative that we see now, if we can't use the Employment Relations Board, is to, one, establish an Employment Relations Board locally, or two, to establish the City Council as the body that resolves these kinds of questions. Obviously, it would be very expensive for every small city in the state to develop its own employment relations board. The second alternative is equally unattractive because it places the city council in the impossible position of trying to represent the interest of their constituents in making policy decisions regarding employment relations while at the same time attempting to fill the role of a neutral body in resolving disputes between labor and management. I've provided the committee with copies of the City of Corvallis Labor Relations Ordinance. I know this ordinance has been discussed before your committee before. I wanted to explain a little bit about it. Basically, what we've done is adopted the state law with two major exceptions. First, rather than traditional fact-finding in the case of an impasse, we provide for last best offer fact-finding. And second, and of course the most controversial and important part of the ordinance, is that rather than compulsory arbitration as the final impasse resolution, we have provided the right to strike for all of the employees of the city, including fire and police personnel. The ordinance does provide that questions of certification, representation, and unfair labor practices will be submitted to the Employment Relations Board. These are provided in Sections 7, 8, and 9 of our ordinance, and it also establishes that we follow the board rules in terms of resolving these conflicts. Our ordinance was passed by the City Council in December 1975, referred to a vote of the people in March 1976, and was approved by the voters. Since that time, we have negotiated four different contracts and have successfully completed them without any third-party involvement. During the last month, we signed a contract, a new three-year contract with the International Association of Firefighters, and a two-year contract just this week with our Corvallis Police Officers Association, which was represented in the negotiations by Teamsters Local 223. Our negotiations with both of these groups were characterized by tough bargaining on both sides, but ultimately we were able to compromise and reach an agreement without mediation, fact-finding, or even the threat of a strike. We think that the ordinance in Corvallis has been successful in eliminating and minimizing labor management disputes, as evidenced by our agreements that we've reached this year. We think it provides a well-balanced framework with the power equally balanced between labor and management. It doesn't lodge all of the power with the City Council. But we need your approval of this proposed legislation, or we need an opinion from the Attorney General so we can utilize the Employment Relations Board as an economical and neutral third party to resolve administrative disputes.
Thank you. Mr. Burkett, to once again reiterate what I told you, there has been no opinion of the Attorney General as of yet on that issue.
I did, however, receive a copy of a letter from the Employment Relations Board to one of our unions after they had requested some assistance, stating that they could not provide assistance because the Attorney General, I don't remember the exact words, but they referred to the Attorney General's office.
I just want you to understand that there's been no opinion yet on that issue. Mm-hmm. Okay. Any questions of Mr. Burkett? Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
Mr. John Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Bailey. I am the Executive Director of Oregon Public Employees Council 75, affiliated with AFSCME and the AFL-CIO. We appear in opposition to this bill. However, I do agree with the chair that the Attorney General has not been requested an opinion, had not been requested an opinion. He has been requested his opinion, and I agree with the chair that I believe that the Attorney General feels that the law would allow a home rule entity to make a decision to come under the collective bargaining law by ordinance. And so if that happens, I don't believe that this piece of legislation would be necessary. However, we are very concerned about this legislation, as we think that it would roll back the time clock to prior collective bargaining law days. And what it does is allow home rule entities the choice of, in effect, being an employer or not. And our concern is with those home rule entities that have chosen to be in effect, anti-union in their stance, and this law wouldn't help in that regard anyway. So we too would reserve, I think, further comment until after the Attorney General does give an opinion, and then at that point the committee would make a determination whether this bill is necessary for further consideration.
Any questions to Mr. Bailey? Representative Rogers.
John, I'm confused. I thought that you wanted your employees to be under the state collective bargaining law.
Yes, we absolutely do. That's correct. The problem with this legislation is that it allows the home rule entity the choice of coming under or not coming under. And in most cases where a city has decided that they will enter into good faith collective bargaining, their local ordinances aren't really all that terrible. You know, we disagree with some of them, but they're really not that bad. At least they allow for good faith collective bargaining. The ones that we have the most problem with would not elect to come under any law. They just choose to stay out and not be considered public employers for the purpose of collective bargaining. So this wouldn't affect them anyway. They just say no.
That's what I was going to ask. Make an assumption that my prior statement wasn't too well thought out when I said that opinion was dumb, and that that opinion is sustained, then wouldn't this be an avenue for some of these employers who do want to have this kind of collective bargaining to come under?
Well, my concern
law?
Is that there are several pieces of legislation before you as a legislator and all legislators now, which would ask for a constitutional amendment bringing home rule counties and cities under the act. Another one is would tie it to revenue share, certain other things. I'm afraid that this might be sort of the red herring across the trail where this might be an easy way out. This doesn't protect the rights of public employees, this bill, we don't believe. We met with a group of public employees from around the state, I believe that it was a significant showing of representation, and they all unanimously oppose this bill because they believe that what will happen is that this will become the way out for the legislature to just simply not worry about the problem. And this doesn't resolve the problem of public employees who do not have the right to collectively bargain now. There would still be those employers who would choose not to bargain at all, and this bill wouldn't take advantage or wouldn't correct that problem.
But what if this bill fails and then those other measures fail also?
Well, if the other measures fail, this one's not going to help us anyway.
It wouldn't help you any at all?
I don't believe it would.
Any further questions, Mr. Bailey? Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Mr. Steve Telfer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee. I'm Steve Telfer. I'm here today on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties and the League of Oregon Cities. I think rather than reading my prepared testimony, I'll save some time and just attempt to speak to the issues raised by some of the previous witnesses. On the back of my testimony is a copy of the informal opinion. I would agree with the chairperson that we don't have today a formal Attorney General's opinion on the impact of the Hermiston decision. However, I think it is fair to point out that the Employment Relations Board has adopted an order dismissing 29 of 31 home rule community cases and has further instructed Mr. Cleveland that they are to not accept any unfair labor practice or bargaining unit determination cases from home rule communities. So the practical effect, even though we don't have the Attorney General opinion today, is that the board, on its own motion, has put home rule communities into a hiatus. The bill that we've asked, and incidentally, thank you, Mr. Chairperson, for agreeing to introduce our bill, is very candidly a Band-Aid bill, and I don't mind saying that. We have a problem right today because we're without services, and public sector labor groups often are heard complaining about the creation of local ordinances and mini herbs and the expense of mini herbs and so on, and all we're trying to do here is to create a situation where at least by enabling legislation, cities or home rule communities that wish to use herb can, and right now we can't. And perhaps if the Attorney General is be forthcoming with an opinion that somehow alters the board's posture on dealing with home rule communities,
legislation would be unnecessary at this point. But.
Steve, let me ask you a question. With this idea of working with the Employment Relations Board, I detected that Mr. Burkett was talking about a different situation than probably most of us are talking about. We generally are looking at the situation where, let's just take an example, that there's a home rule city that has no collective bargaining ordinance or charter provision, and they wish to have it, and they just pass an ordinance and said that the city shall comply with the comply with the provisions of the state laws that relates to collective bargaining for public employees, and they in essence just completely come under the state law on unfair labor practice and everything. I understand that situation, but Mr. Burkett's talking about a different situation.
Yes.
He's talking about picking and choosing which aspects of the state law that he wants to come under. Now, do you think that that's possible?
Well, what we visualize, of course, is the potential of having what we call a contracting public employer. It's my personal view that, in fact, that's perhaps possible today under Chapter 190, the Intergovernmental Agreement, where Corvallis, as an example, would have their ordinance, which differs from the state law, but seeks the use of ERB as the
inter-party
on administrative.
Now, that's another factor, though. See, now, the second situation I gave you is to say, well, look, I've got all my own unfair labor practice and everything. What I do not have is an impasse procedure, and I wish to come under the state law for the impasse procedure. Now, that's it. But, you know, you're still complying with the state law. But Mr. Burkett's taken it one step further, and he, as I understand, does not really want the state law, any of its provisions. All he wants is the administrative apparatus of the Employment Relations Board to administer the Corvallis Ordinance.
Well, to administer portions of the Corvallis Ordinance, bargaining unit determinations.
Okay.
So.
Under the ordinance, though, not under the state law determination.
That's right. And even at the willingness to pay a fee, just a contractual fee for ERB to provide those kinds of administrative services, rather than having a mini ERB in its place. And of course, what we've attempted to do with 2669 is to respect the fact that today the law of the land in Oregon, based on the Court of Appeals decision, is that the State Collective Bargaining Act is unconstitutional as it applies to home rule communities. And therefore, short of the Supreme Court deciding to take that on review and overturning that whole decision, challenging the Hynek Doctrine, the balancing test concept that we've talked about before, we have to respect the fact that the Home Rule Articles in the Constitution are going to always permit cities to do their own thing in employment relations matters. But we'd like to have and preserve the maximum flexibility so that those cities, the small cities that would prefer to just adopt the state act in total or in fact adopt an ordinance that differs from the state law on impasse or otherwise, can by becoming a public contractor at least have the services of ERB. And this based on the Solicitor General's letter, which we have a copy of, and the Employment Relations Board's personal thinking about it at this point, we don't have that.
Steve, I guess the thing is that I mean this in no disrespect to the Employment Relations Board, but I think that they do not have the ability, if they are going to go out and be the administrative arm for all the city and county's collective bargaining ordinances. Now, you know, not the situation where they adopt the state law, but the fact is the city adopts their own ordinance and then tells ERB to come in and enforce it. You're just putting an impossible burden upon them because I don't think that there are many judges that could travel around the state, and if there was a different law in every state, to ask them to sit in every city or county to sit down there and ask them to interpret that law to that situation. I just don't think it's not possible to me because I think that you're just creating more problems than you're ever going
to
solve.
With all due respect, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that prior to 1973, in some respects, we had that kind of situation where we had public employers and they had a variety of different kinds of ordinances, and ERB was providing certain kinds of administrative services there without any particular problem.
As I understand it, ERB's administrative services, the election at that time was to come under the state law. See, in fact, that's what your bill does.
Right.
If you remember that there was a statewide,
we had a collective bargaining act and it was to become a public employer under the
act. That's right. The employer had to elect, and that's what got him into the thing. And that's what your bill does. But I'm just saying it. I think that Mr. Bailey, and we're all probably talking about the same thing, this is a last resort on the idea of electing, if you want collective bargaining,
to buy into the state concept. But the idea to have Herb go out and administer the local ordinances, I have a great deal of difficulty with. I don't think they have the ability to do that.
Well, I think I would probably share your view on that. Our primary concern is one of timing. The court has a massive overload, the Supreme Court, we understand, and even if they were to decide next week they will take that up on review, we're probably talking about a substantial period of time before they're going to render a decision. And in the meantime, we have agencies like Washington County that are caught in that very awkward spot where they have home rule with respect to the county employees and have to operate under the statute with respect to the Unified Sewerage Agency employees. It's a very awkward kind of situation.
Yes, Representative Rogers.
Have any of your clients, Steve, thought about going to court to force ERB to take this jurisdiction?
I don't think it's fair to say that any of our clients have necessarily thought about it. I have thought about that possibility and really haven't examined it yet until we see for sure what the Attorney General has cognizant of the fact that the Chairman had asked for a more formal opinion. But it's my personal view that the board is probably operating outside of the law in dismissing these 29 cases. They've not yet had a mandate from the court.
And second question is, under the question that I had asked earlier, the portion of ERB that deals with our little NLRA, wouldn't that bring these employers under?
No, that problem there is that public employers, because of the fact we had the State Collective Bargaining Act, were excluded, and under NLRA, they're also excluded.
I see.
So they're out in the
open. Okay, you really put them out there.
Any further questions? Steve, I know the committee's going to monitor the actions, and it may be that we're going to have to come back to this at some time. I've got some problems with some of the idea, the language in it, but it may be that it has to be a vehicle before the session's over.
Well, we appreciate just hanging on to it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. I appreciate it. Is there anyone else that cares to testify on as to House Bill 2669? Yes, Bill?
Mr. Chairman, while he's coming up and getting position, I noticed the coffee is a little bit strong. And
a little bit.
I want you to know that Jan gave me instructions on how to make it this morning.
I think you did a very good job.
Yeah,
I like it.
Well,
she gave me instructions too. Did you put in the coffee?
We're going to make you an honorary firefighter.
Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bill Fitzgerald with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and just for the record, we had a meeting with all public employee groups that are affiliated with the AFL-CIO, and we would just like to state that we are in opposition to this bill, and that I would just like for the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. Any questions? None. Steve, do you want to say something again?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify your question about the problem, and I agree it would be a problem if the ERB had to go and administer and interpret several different ordinances throughout the state. But in our ordinances, you'll notice in Section 7, 8, and 9, we simply adopt the appropriate ORS, and we have exactly the same language for our unfair labor practices, et cetera, as the state law. So they wouldn't be administering some unique ordinance in that respect. They'd be administering the state law. We also adopt the procedures of the board. We make reference that we will follow the board procedures.
Yes.
Would it be, Steve, would it be hard to put in an ordinance, just simply put the ORS number right in the ordinance then, if it's the same as the state law?
That's what we've done.
You actually have the state laws as part of the ordinance.
Right.
I didn't see that.
That's 7, 8, and 9 of Section 7, 8, and 9.
Section 6 deals with unfair labor practice.
I think then Section 7, I gave my copy of the ordinance away. Section 7, I think, deals with the administration of it, or...
It doesn't adopt the whole act, it just adopts part of it.
Right.
Steve, let me give you an example of what you've done, just reading your ordinance. You've substantially limited, or it's different than the state law, the definition of employment relations. You've changed that. Now, what my concern is that you adopt the state law as far as an unfair labor practice on refusal to bargain in good faith. Now, the ERB definition or the state law definition on employment relations is somewhat broader than yours.
Now, what are they going to do if there's an unfair labor practice on a refusal to bargain in good faith over certain subjects that may be mandatory under the state law but are not included within your definition? What are they going to do?
They'd have, I guess, just have to make the decision whether they were going to follow theirs, follow precedents they've set in terms of scope of bargaining, or ours. I would think that in that situation you have a pretty uniform set of criteria through some of the decisions of this board and of the NLRB in terms of, you know, what's appropriate for bargaining and what isn't.
Okay, and that's one of the problems. I mean, I can just see that there's just a multitude of these things that that every city or county could do this, and when they sit down, they've got a new fact situation every time and a new law, well, not a new fact situation, a new law to interpret.
And I understand that, and that's why we attempted in developing our ordinance to follow the state law as much as possible in those areas. Another key point is that the City Council of Corvallis is committed to do some consistent standards in terms of representation, the rights of employees to organize and to select representatives, and I think that those kinds of things could probably be matters of statewide concern. Should probably be.
He also changed the definition of supervisory employee from the state law.
Are you sure? I know we considered that, but I think we left in that phrase, last sentence.
No, if you look on page 3 of Ordinance 3, it's taken out the last sentence.
Okay. I think that clarifies the definition of supervisory employee.
It's substantially different than the state law. The state law intentionally modified the NLRB precedent under that. And that's the position you're putting them in, and I don't think we can do that, personally. I just think it's an intolerable situation.
Of course, we didn't have any problem in the definition of supervisors as the board decided that they agreed with the city when that, you know.
Mr. Burkett, the moral of the story is you should never attack pride of authorship.
I like the definition.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome. I'm going to open a hearing up this time to House Bill 2679. Mr. Bailey, you seem to be the only one that has an interest in this bill.
I was assuming that the Planning Division was here on this bill.
They're here.
I would assume wait until they finish.
Okay. Ed, do you want to come up?
Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Ed Nordyke, and I'm Assistant Attorney General and Counsel to the Employment Division. House Bill 2679 is designed to solve a problem which the Employment Division has had, has been experiencing with respect to settlement agreements with public employers. The problem arises in this way. Often, a dismissed employee files a claim for and receives unemployment benefits. And then subsequent to having been receiving unemployment benefits, they may enter into a settlement agreement on the dismissal, or IRB may order the reinstatement of the employee with back pay. Now that results in a benefit overpayment to the individual who has drawn the benefits. And we are in a position of having to get voluntary repayment of that benefit overpayment, or to have it deducted from future benefits. Since it was not the result of a fraud or misrepresentation, we don't have authority to go after it in a civil action. Customarily, the public employer, who is on a reimbursable basis, deducts from the award of back pay that may be involved the amount of benefits that the person had drawn, unemployment insurance benefits. And they deduct that from the award of back pay. This winds up then, the public employer has the money. We do not have it. Frequently, that money may not all belong to the public employer because the benefits may have been based upon some wage credits earn from other employers who are not public employers. So this bill is designed to solve that problem. It requires wherever there is a settlement agreement from a public employer with an award of back pay that takes into consideration the unemployment insurance benefits that the individual drew, they would have to take into consideration ORS 657.315, which we have amended on page 6 of the bill, so as to require that any amount deducted in the settlement or award of back pay take into account the benefits paid and they're reimbursed by the public employer to the employment division. The employment division then will credit that public employer if he has already paid it, if he has already paid it to us, or we'll give him credit as though he had paid it, and we will also credit the other base year employers who may be involved. So, and finally, the last part of it, we will then cancel the benefit overpayment that the claimant has drawn, because now the fund has been reimbursed. So it would solve the entire problem, we think, in this bill. We think it's a good bill.
Ed, let me ask you this. In the private sector, what's the rule as far as the back pay award?
Then they would also be unentitled to the benefits that they had received.
Do you ever,
well, they're on a tax basis, you see. They're not on reimbursable. We don't have this problem with the other employers. The only problem here is that when you have the two mixed, we're unable to credit that employer, at least to give his account the benefit so that his experience rate would not be affected.
Now, I take it what you've done in the bill is you've just gone to the merit system law,
yes,
to the collective bargaining law, and to the teacher tenure law, which are the three that govern.
I tried to pick out all those that were involved in that.
Now, let me ask you that as far as the something in the back of my mind is telling me that there's a case before the Supreme Court right now, and they've had it for about 4 months, and I do not think that they granted review, but I can't remember if the issue was whether the unemployment benefits should be an offset to the, I know that's what the Employment Relations Board's ruled, is that the unemployment benefits are an offset to the back pay award. But
yes,
something tells me that that case is up in the Supreme Court as to whether it should be that way or not. I don't think that's the issue that's up. Mel, it's the Central Point case. And the court has not granted review of that case yet. They've got it under, you know, they've had it for 4 months. And I don't know what...
I don't think that the issue in this bill is...
That isn't an issue on appeal then?
No.
Okay.
Well, I was unaware of if there was a case on that. We have taken no cases up, but I think this would eliminate an administrative problem that we have in getting the account settled, both for the public employer and the private employer, as well as to remove the benefit overpayment decision that has been entered against the claimant.
Any further questions, Mr. Nordack? Mr. Rogers.
We can state categorically that this has nothing to do with Public Law 94-566.
Nothing at all.
I'd say
in fact, this was not even, this is one that I dreamed up because we were having these problems, and one of my associates in the office suggested this way of settling the problem, and I thought it was such a good idea that I took it over to the Employment Division, and they liked it, so we drafted a bill.
Well, I'm concerned about this bill, Ed, because I can understand it. Something's got to be wrong.
And I guess the thing is, you know, it's an interesting, you know, the way it's presented, because it appears there's no problem between the employer and the employee. They work it out. The employer offsets his back pay liability by the amount of unemployment, but I take it your concern is that the employer just doesn't forward, or there's no way that...
Well, very often the employee isn't aware at that time that he's going to be stuck with an overpayment, and it isn't going to be canceled until somebody reimburses the trust fund.
Okay. Whose responsibility is it going to be, the employer's?
No, we're going to do it when we have the money that has been deducted from his back pay. It's going to be paid over to us, and we're going to credit the employee and remove the overpayment. We're also going to credit the public employer for having paid the unemployment benefits,
and we will take care of the private employer as well.
You pay an employee is paid, let's just say as an example, $500 in unemployment benefits. He gets into a settlement agreement with his employer on the discharge. The employer agrees to rehiring, and the employee has $1,000 back pay award. That's the lump sum.
Yes.
The employer offsets the unemployment by $500. So the employee gets $500 in his pocket for his back pay award.
Yes.
Who are you going to go after to get the other $500?
Well, the $500, it's provided for in line 13 of page 6.
Okay. That I don't want the employee to take any hassle over this.
He will have none.
Okay.
This will help him.
Okay. It's the employer's burden to get that money back to you.
Right.
Okay. Not no problem.
So it will remove any argument from the public employer that since he's on a reimbursable basis and he's just made himself whole, that he doesn't have to, he has no obligation in this. And so we will credit the public employer or refund the money if that's what is required.
Okay. That's what I want to make sure of. Thank you, Ed.
Yeah.
Mr. John Bailey?
I think that conversation has cleared up my concern, Mr. Chairman. So I just do not know.
May I ask,
yes,
John, a question? Are you supportive of the bill? Or?
Well, my concern was that the bill got into a...
John Bailey, AFSCME Council 75. My concern was that the bill got into the area of influencing how a settlement would come about. And I certainly have no quarrel with the Employment Division attempting to take care of the accounts as long as the employee isn't involved in that hassle. If a settlement is made and there needs to be an accredited made to an account, I don't have any quarrel with the Employment Division doing that.
You're in support of the bill.
I don't believe we have any problem with it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative. Well,
what happens in the case of a non-public employer in this situation? You say you don't have a problem. What does happen in the case of a non-public employer?
Chairman, I'm Ed Northcutt, Deputy Administrator for the Employment Division. In the private sector there, we normally ask the money be paid to us. In other words, in reconciling the overpayment. In other words, either the claimant has an overpayment, which is charged against him, and he then has some interest in also working with the employer to get that money back into the trust fund so that the trust fund is eventually made whole, as opposed to leaving the claimant with the benefits and the employer with an offset for any of the benefits that he has taken credit for.
Who pays it back? Employer or the employee? I mean, when there's a settlement, are you going to...
Generally, we look to the court order that has made the award or the agreement. In other words, it'll go either way. And there's never been any problem with regard to the private sector and those workers that are involved in those types of settlements. In fact, they occur less frequent than they do in the public sector.
Gary, I think it's a general rule of arbitration that the back pay award is offset by any unemployment compensation that the individual receives. So that this bill isn't making that a rule. I think that's already an established rule.
So both employees, public or private, are going to be treated the same.
Right. Neither one will profit from the deal, nor neither one of the employers.
Well, they both profit a little bit from the deal because they're not paying any tax on the unemployment compensation.
In regards to unemployment benefits.
No, that's right.
They're both coming out a little better after the settlement than they would if they were working. Financially, I mean.
I'll acquiesce to that.
Okay. My concern is that if they're going to come out better, that both of them come out better and not just the public employee or just the private employee.
Now, as Mr. Nordyke testified, the biggest problem involves the reimbursing employers and trying to make sure that the proper employer gets credit. And in the past here, we haven't had any, we've had nothing more than, shall we say, pleading with him and trying to show him that what is right and what's wrong. We've had no legal authority to go after it. And we've frequently had to write many letters, telephone calls, and finally convince him, and finally go maybe to the attorney that represents the public entity and show him the rightness or wrongness of, shall we say, accounting methods. Now then, we're looking for some legal authority that would make it correct that these accountings take place.
Okay. Thank you.
Does anyone else care to testify as 2679? Hearing none, it's going to be the bill was going to be set on the next work session. Hearing is closed. The hearing will now open to House Bill 2718. Mr. Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Bailey, for the record, represent the Oregon Public Employees Council 75. I assume that there would be other people here today to speak on this bill. However, for the record, our organization does support House Bill 2718. We believe that if an employee is involved in a legal strike, that upon a contract settlement, that it should be incumbent upon the employer to culminate in good faith collective bargaining to allow employees to come back to work with full seniority credits and so forth. We have had some experience where employees have been denied the right to come back to work. We had one occasion in Astoria. However, since there's home rule involved, I don't think that that's really a real fair analysis. However, there has been problems. There is not a mechanism under the state collective bargaining law that allows employees that are on a legal strike to the right to return to work at the end of a strike. And this law would in effect, I think, finish that section of the law that allows an employee to go on a legal strike once there is a settlement of the dispute, a collective bargaining agreement is reached. Then there would be a law on the records that would allow the employees the right to return to their job with full benefits.
John, looking at the bill, the one definition you do not have is the definition of employer. And you've tied the bill into ORS Chapter 663, and what concerns me is the bill limited to only private sector employers?
Well, it wasn't our intent that it be restricted to private employers. Maybe in drafting of the bill that it has inadvertently been designed to do so.
I think you have a problem, because if you put it in, and I would assume that legislative counsel, because the definition tie-ins are to the private sector, that what this proviso would be put in to the private sector provisions of the statute, and if they did that, I do not believe that it would be found to be applicable to the public sector, and I think you're going to need an amendment to tie it into the public employee collective bargaining law if that's what you want.
Well, that's certainly our intent. We represent no private employees, so it's our intent that the law would apply to both. We did not have the law drafted, so it was probably inadvertently dropped in the drafting.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Wilhelms.
Isn't this a... I can't believe that an employer doesn't have to take somebody back after a legal strike now.
No.
So there's got to be conditions that exist beyond that.
Gary, it's a very legalistic subject area, and you have to distinguish, first of all, between unfair labor practice strikes and economic strikes. And with an unfair labor practice strike, they are required to reinstate.
Yeah.
With an economic strike, you just basically, if you have been permanently replaced and all the requirements of notice and everything like this.
Oh, like, for example, the old Oregonian strike that we so often refer to.
I'm not familiar with what
I
happened.
Believe that strike was a legal strike in the pure legal sense.
Yeah.
It was a legal strike. So what you're saying is that all those people that were out on strike that were not taken back would have had to have been taken back.
Well, there was no agreement reached in that case. There was never an agreement reached, and so the union, in effect, was busted there.
You've got to be careful with the word legal. I mean, that is not the key feature of the thing. You have to take the strike and break them down into unfair labor practice and economic strikers. And the question, I mean, the thing is, if you engage in an illegal strike, I don't think that there's any doubt the employer can terminate the employee.
Well, I've got a couple of very, specific concerns, Mr. Chairman, on this. First of all, I can envision where a strike might take place, and it might be a type of business where the nature of the work would be seasonal or something like that, where they regularly have a decrease in the workforce during the period of time that the strike might be in progress. But if they had been working, there might have been a layoff because of some seasonal work or something. So the demands for employees would be less after the strike issue was resolved, but the employer is going to be in a position where he's going to have to take everybody back, at least for a day, and then lay them off after the strike's concluded. Well, I don't like that. The second thing I don't like is the 10 days, because if you take this at face value, a person could be gone on a trip while the strike was on. The strike's over. He's still gone on his trip. As long as he gets back before the 10th day, he can make the application in writing to be reinstated, and they've got to take it back. And I don't buy that.
Okay. Well, I don't think it's the intent that people would have the choice to...
Yeah, I'm not saying it's the intent. I'm just saying that that's a technical problem I see in the bill, the way it's written right now. I hope I see what your intent is, and I
well, the problem,
don't dispute that too much.
The problem that we're faced with is that if you have a for example, a city, just talking about public employees now, you have a city of, say, 5 to 10 people, and a labor dispute culminates in a strike in that case, normally it's possible to replace all of those people.
Mm-hmm.
If you only have a handful of employees, you can replace them fairly easily. If they're replaced, and then subsequently there is a labor contract negotiated and agreed to, there's really no mechanism in the law that says that the people that replace the striking employees have to then be terminated and the striking employees have a right to their job back. So you can get into a situation where you have a contract which covers people who are no longer working there. I suppose that you could, as a union, assert your right to represent those employees that are on the job, because you'd have a contract with the employer. But our concern is that if employees that are so affected go out on strike and a settlement's reached, they should have their job back, not the people that were hired to come in while they were on strike.
Yeah. Well, I don't disagree with that, but I really thought that was the case under existing law.
You have to be permanently replaced, and there's a notification the employees make after the labor dispute's resolved. They make an unconditional offer to return to work, and then what you get, and that's an economic strike, and what happens at that point, an economic strike, what happens is if you have been permanently replaced, you go on the preferential hiring list. You're the next, what the NLRB will do is they will actually supply a list of people to be hired back, and then you have to be hired back if in fact it's an economic strike, according to that order, if you have been permanently replaced. But most employers generally, that I've been experienced with, do not permanently replace. There's always threats of permanent replacement, but whether in fact they actually get down to it, I don't know. And generally it's an issue that in the private sector, I'm not going to speak for the public sector, but for the private sector, it's usually an item that's negotiated in the contract on the return to work.
Right.
That everybody comes back. John, I think that there's got a lot to be done with the bill, because I think that who you're trying to get after, and I think it's a legitimate purpose, I don't think this vehicle does it.
I agree, Mr.
the way
Chairman,
it's worth.
And we will propose an amendment to change the intent so that it does cover public employees. I think that, however, we speak for public employees, and the AFL-CIO or their other affiliates can speak about the problems that they've had in the private sector a lot better than I can.
Gary, let me just say one thing. I don't think the bill changes the law as it is to unfair labor practice strikers, other than the fine aspect of it. I do believe that it would substantially change the law as to economic strikers.
Mr. Chairman?
Because that there would be, this bill would say they would have to be rehired. And the law doesn't say they have to be rehired if they've been permanently replaced. They just have to go on the preferential hiring list.
Well, as a matter of, when you said that usually it's a part of the bargaining agreement, contract is signed, that generally that is included in a contract, that employees are reinstated, as a matter of fact, many times with retroactive pay and so on.
Right.
And I guess, Mr. Chairman, I just, I don't have any problem with the intent, but I guess maybe this is one of those items that could be taken care of at the bargaining table and not necessarily in the legislature. I just an opinion.
Okay.
Representative Rogers.
And to be sure that we're on record as to what we're talking about here, labor dispute has the meaning under ORS 663.005 that says includes any controversy concerning terms, tenure, or conditions of employment, or concerning the association or representation of persons in negotiating, fixing, maintaining, changing, or seeking to arrange terms or conditions of employment, regardless of whether the disputants stand in the proximate relation of employer and employee. And strike has the meaning under 662.205, and that says that strike means any concerted act of employees in a lawful refusal under applicable state or federal law to perform work or services for an employer. So, you know, that says lawful in the strike, and if the strike was held to be unlawful, of course, it would not apply. But this going into Section 2 makes no provision whatsoever for any agreement between the two disputing parties whatsoever. It just says if they were out on a legal strike in a labor dispute, that they're entitled to this back. And it's very simple, makes no bones about it.
No, I agree with that.
Okay.
I think the count. Representative Starr.
First concern that Representative Williams said that the employer would have to take the striking employee back and maybe work him a day. I don't think that what reinstate necessarily means that. If there was no work. Really?
I don't. It's
yeah,
a question.
I read into that he would have to get his rights back, including no loss of seniority. Is that what?
That
would
was
you
my
understanding,
that Representative Starr, yes.
Place on the list to
if
go
you're
back
on
to work when the work was there, would that would be unimpaired, but he wouldn't necessarily have to guarantee him a day or an hour or any other.
My understanding of the intent of that section was that, if, for example, if you were on a 10-month job and the strike was settled in the 11th month of, you know, of mm-hmm. your normal work year, that you would have the right to come back the next year as you normally would.
In your turn.
And your seniority
yeah.
would prevail in that case.
That's what I read into it.
I'd feel more comfortable if it was clarified.
Okay.
I'm kind of like Representative Rogers. I like to be able to understand him when I read him.
Any other questions of Mr. Bailey? Anybody else?
Thank you, John.
Standing list.
Mr. Kalinowski's going to give us a refresher in labor law.
Oh,
I
okay.
saw his text.
Yeah, there it is.
He's in support of this bill.
Yes, he's got his authority mustered to come out in support of this, I know.
Testify.
No, Jack, I...
Testify, Mr. Chairman, I absolutely refuse to answer any questions.
Go ahead, Jack.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack Kalinowski. I represent the Associated General Contractors, and we're signed up in opposition to this bill. Mr. Chairman, construction contractors, the people I represent, are subject to the conditions of the Taft-Hartley Act, the National Labor Relations Act. This bill does not exempt those who are subject to the Taft-Hartley Act. As we read the bill, it would appear that we would be subject to both in this particular case. We feel that's improper. The Taft-Hartley Act creates the National Labor Relations Board, which provides sanctions when an employer fails to follow the rules following a labor dispute. Those sanctions are applicable in our instances and are applied. And I'll discuss those sanctions just a little bit from what I know of them. And under the Taft-Hartley Act, an employer is required to rehire strikers if the dispute involved an unfair labor practice and was resolved in favor of the employees. And if the dispute, the labor dispute, was an economic strike, under the Taft-Hartley Act, the employer is not required to rehire the strikers. The sanctions that I mentioned are usually include reinstatement with back pay, including fringes, including bonuses, sometimes including Christmas bonuses that might be applicable, but they never include a penalty. At least to the best of our knowledge, they've never included a penalty. One of the problems that we see in this bill as it is written is that it fails to recognize the following: a lawful dispute and the settlement of that dispute, that it's terribly important that a construction project commence as early as possible. If an employer searches for the employees that were on strike but cannot find them, or if he does find them and they initially refuse to return to work, the way I read the bill, at any rate, as it is drafted, the employer would be subject to a fine if the employee came back within 10 days and said, "I changed my mind, I want to go back to work," and the employer said, "Well, I've already, you told me no in the first instance, and I've now hired a permanent replacement." The other thing that it appears in the drafting of this bill is that it does not cover the condition where the strike is lawful. And I'm talking about one involving a dispute under an unfair labor practice, but is resolved in favor of the employer. I don't know how this bill would be applicable in that particular instance.
It wouldn't be an unfair labor practice strike if the employer wins.
Well, it could be an allegation of an unfair labor practice, Mr. Chairman, but resolved in favor of the employer. That's what I'm trying to get at. And the bill also does not exempt, as the Taft-Hartley Act does, those who have been guilty of strike misconduct or who have been discharged for cause, as has been determined, I understand, through case law. The other thing that's very interesting about this, it talks about a penalty of up to $10,000, but the bill does not identify whether this penalty is applicable to each violation, that is, for each employee who requests to be reinstated, or whether it's one fine for each employer. That could be a terribly great fine if it's imposed to its maximum limit. And
per employee,
to each employee, yes.
I mean, that would be profitable, Jack, for the employer to resolve the strike.
Be more profitable to cash in his performance bond. The last comment that I have written down concerning this bill is a question that that becomes very applicable because of another little gem that's now being considered in the Congress of the United States, and I don't need to identify that issue, I don't think, for anybody, but the question that I would need answered by this is a person who refuses to cross another's picket line engaged in a strike, the voluntary action of an electrician, Representative Otto, who voluntarily refuses to cross a plumber's picket line. When we get common sight as picket line, we're going to get it. I'm convinced of that.
United we stand, divided we fall.
Solidarity forever, Representative Otto.
That's the motto of the AGC. Do you know that?
Skill, integrity, and responsibility.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I have to keep reminding myself. But anyway, those are some of the concerns that we have concerning this act, and should it be enacted, in any case, I would urge this committee to include a provision or an exemption for those who are subject to the Taft-Hartley Act.
Let me clarify that for you, that under ORS 663.005, the definition of employee, and it has a rather lengthy definition, but it says, but does not include an individual, and down in sub I, it says, employed by an employer subject to the jurisdiction of the National Labor Relations Board under the existing jurisdictional standards pursuant to the Labor Management Relations Acts of 47 and 59. And then it goes on further and it says employer does not include any person subject to the jurisdiction of the National Labor Relations Board. And under the same thing, I don't think that this bill would cover you. I think that you'd all be exempt if this was put into that statute.
There is, and I'm sure you're familiar with the Taft-Hartley Act as it identifies those who are subject to the National Labor Relations Act. It is possible that that a number of employers are frankly not knowledgeable, and a number of people serving in the legislature are not knowledgeable as to whether or not they would be affected by this particular bill. Hence, I think it's quite appropriate that such an exemption be in any kind of legislation of this type. It might be well to identify for the benefit of the committee when the federal act preempts.
You know, Jack, I just thinking about it very quickly, since the Congress has already exercised jurisdiction over this area, I think it has preempted this whole field as for all these employees that are covered by the act. But I understand your concern to having it spelled out. But I do not think that the law would, put it this way, even if you didn't have the exclusions there, I think you're into the preemption problem. And I think the federal law would preempt. And I think they've got a program already on how people come back to work.
I trust your judgment. You're much more familiar with the law than I am. I would just like to avoid the expense of a court case to later to make that determination.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Chairman.
Oh, wait, go away.
Okay,
so where's the dividing line between an economic strike and a strike involving an unfair labor practice? What did you say? Where is the line between the two?
Who's drawing it, the employee or the employee?
I don't know.
Well, generally
traditionally draws the line.
I don't know that you can draw a finite line, but generally an economic strike is one that is a labor dispute at the end or near the end of a contract in which the employer or employers are attempting to negotiate wages, fringes, and that type of compensation to employees that are organized through the union. Unfair labor practices strike is generally doesn't address the subject of wages and fringes. Generally would involve work practices under the terms of the labor union agreement. It's my understanding.
In other words, if the employer would not provide
water. Yes, I understand. That's how I understand.
No question about that. No question at all about that.
It's a constitutional violation of laying under the cruel and unusual punishment.
Right.
Yeah. Mr. Frederick, I'm sorry. Yeah, I was going to say, Carl, I never know what capacity you're in.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor.
Carl, would you come up here?
Carl Frederick, Employee Benefits Director for Associated Oregon Industries. And we're in opposition to this bill. I was going to say that after Jack's rather erudite explanation of the situation and the questions, I think it brought out the technical problems of the bill. I don't know if there's a great deal I could add, unless you want a long dissertation from Commerce Clearinghouse and the research I did last night on economic strikes, perhaps some examples and this type of thing. It's up to you.
I know.
You don't want to hear me.
No.
You don't want me like that.
I want to know what an erudite is.
Jack, one of us has been defamed, but I don't know which one. Yeah. I'm going to assume it was you.
Mr. Chairman, I will leave my copy of CCH with respect to the research on it with your committee clerk. It'll explain some of these situations with respect to the economic strikes compared to unfair labor.
Thank you, Carl. You know, to the members of the committee, when looking at the bill, I think it has some problems the way it's worded, even if it's going to be to the benefit of the employee. I note that there's no provision in here that he be reinstated to his former position, which concerns me very much. And just reinstatement doesn't mean much unless you're going to get him back into his job. And I would hate to see Representative Otto get relegated to a position of cleaning out all of those things that...
Those washhouses.
Yes, this reinstatement. So I think that it's going to have to be worked over. And then, as you probably are well aware, it's a major policy decision of how you want to approach it at that particular point.
If the example you used, Mr. Chairman, we're correct, I think it's in need of major revision.
I think it is.
Perhaps a motion would be more in order.
Well, I would like to see if, in fact, it can be worked out. I think the intent of it is some of us are in agreement with, but the way it's written, we're having problems with it. Is there anything else to come before the committee? We have a new agenda out for the next 2 weeks after this week. You'll note that there's no meeting scheduled for Friday, April the 1st. That is so that members of the committee who wish to go up to the Water Resource Conference are able to attend. Oh, I'm sorry. I knew I forgot somebody. Pat, would you please...
Pat Randall, Oregon AFL-CIO, and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we were, prior to this hearing, aware of some problems existing in this legislation. Since hearing the testimony, we're aware of even more problems than we had anticipated, and we will be drafting amendments, and we'll be coming back with those amendments.
Thank you, Pat. I appreciate it. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Hearing none, we're adjourned. Session starts at 10:30.